morning and welcome. I'm Michael Green, the clerk of Green's List. The topics, of course, I have forgotten, but I know it's Wills and Estates and I know it's Executors Commission, but I've forgotten the exact titles. Catherine is speaking on the who, what, when and how of Executors Commission. Catherine's been at the bar for the last 12 months. Prior to that, she was an associate to Justice Hollingworth of the Supreme Court for 18 months. And prior to that, she worked for several years, maybe probably three or four, looking at Russell Kennedy and Dibbs Abbott Stillman in the commercial area and including wills and estates. So I'd welcome Catherine Hamill.
Thank you. I understand that you may have a copy of the paper, so I don't propose to go through it or read it because in effect you can do that after if you so wish. I also think that you might have a copy of a paper that Kate co-authored. There are some areas of overlap in the papers, so I think if you read both of the papers you get a fairly good idea of the general who, what, when and how of Executors Commission. That said, I don't really propose to go through those items in that order, but I thought it sounded better that way. Very briefly, I understand that most people will already know this, but Executors Commission is in effect a payment from the estate for the pains and troubles of administering the estate. There's a very old definition which is still used today to the effect that pains is the executor's responsibility, anxiety and worry in regard to his or her duties as an executor, and the troubles consist of the actual work done in administering the estate. Now, the focus of this paper is an application for commission to the Supreme Court under Section 65 of the Act. However, there are two other means by which an executor can obtain commission, which I'll just cover very briefly and which I've covered briefly in the paper. The first is where there is a clause in the will which allows for the executor to be remunerated for his or her pains and troubles, and the section or the clause of the will effectively provide that. In those circumstances, in most cases, the executor is in effect bound by the remuneration in the will and can't make an application under Section 65 for further remuneration. There is an exception to that where effectively exceptional circumstances exist whereby the remuneration provided for in the will is insufficient. There was a case in 2003, a case of Justice Kellams called Re-White, where the question of exceptional circumstances was covered, and I've discussed that on pages 1 and following on to page 2 of the paper. There were a number of factors in that case which meant that the remuneration was insufficient as provided in the will and there was exceptional circumstances. I've set out some of those factors there. I would have thought that you'd be very hard-pressed to find a case involving that many exceptional circumstances, and so I don't think that you're effectively precluded from making an application for extra commission where you don't have each and every one of those factors. Having regard to the matters or the cases that His Honour discussed in the judgment, I think, though, if you wanted to make an arguable case for additional commission, you'd probably have to have two factors. The first would be where the remuneration is exceptionally small. I believe illusory was one of the words used in one of the cases. Or where perhaps the remuneration is based on, for example, shares in a company or dividends from shares in a company, and where the company has gone belly up in such a way as the testator could not have anticipated at the time of drawing up the will. And the second would be that you would need to have some aspect of the administration of the estate that was greatly increased in size in a way that the testator could not have anticipated. In the case of White, that involved the company, the income of which was to be distributed to a number of charities, was taken over, and so the proceeds of the takeover needed to be invested, and that created a lot more work for the for the trustees. And so you would need something of that nature, I think, in order to, along with the question of the inadequate remuneration to establish exceptional circumstances. The second case, or the second example of a situation where you can get Executors Commission without needing to make an application under Section 65, is where you have the consent of all the adult beneficiaries to commission being granted in a particular percentage. As to that, if you're a solicitor and you're claiming, particularly if you're a solicitor and you're claiming or seeking consent of the beneficiaries on that basis, you need to be quite careful that you get their informed consent. There was recently a case of Walker and Alessandro, which I understand that Kate will be discussing, so I won't go into that, but it's something that you might wish to look at, or you probably should look at. There was also a decision of Master Evans, as His Honour then was, in 2006, called the Estate of McClung, which goes into quite some detail about the concept of getting informed consent and the appropriate work that you can do as a solicitor executor. And again, I would suggest that you have a look at that. In fact, Master Evans indicated at the end of the judgment that if you are consulted by a client who wishes you to draw a will and who wants you to include a charging clause for your own work, and where it's anticipated that you might make some claim for executor's commission as well, it would be advised that you not draw the will or that you provide at least quite significant disclosure. The Master indicated at the end of the judgment that the LIV might wish to change its guidelines or its code of conduct to reflect that. I contacted the Law Institute and they have a draft code of conduct which for some reason has been in draft form since 2008, which does address the issues raised in McClung in regulations or rules 35 and 36. That's available on the Law Institute website if you wanted to have a look, if you were so interested. Moving on then to the question of an application under section 65, and I'm looking from page 2 onwards of the paper. Very briefly, it's probably best to make an application towards the end of administration of the estate because it's generally commission is awarded on the basis of work already done. You also are required to file an administration account at the time of making your application, so if you make the application too early, it's likely to be refused, or even if it's granted, the amount of commission may not be adequately reflecting the work that the executor is required to do under the will. On pages 2 and 3, I deal with the question of solicitor executors, the situation where there are multiple executors, and the situation where the executor is also a beneficiary under the will. I'll leave you to read that yourself. Insofar as paragraph 12 is concerned, however, I did note some particular points from McClung where there was a charging clause in the will entitling the solicitor to charge for his professional work, but he had made a claim, of course, for professional work and executorial work, which is effectively the non-professional work. If you are making a claim, even for professional fees pursuant to a charging clause under a will, you do need to be somewhat careful to ensure that you don't fall into, for example, two of the problems that Master Evans identified in McClung. The solicitor's bill had been taxed, or had been costed rather, and the Master pointed out a number of apparent inconsistencies and problems with the bill, including the fact that for the purpose of a Part 4 proceeding, the solicitor had charged instructions when he was the one giving the instructions, so he was effectively charging the estate for instructing himself. The executor had also claimed an amount for pains and troubles of dealing with the Part 4 proceeding, and the Master noted that it would be difficult for a solicitor to make out the concept of pains and troubles when you all, or at least most of you, deal with litigation on a day-to-day basis and are used to dealing with people who are in the position of, I suppose, plaintiffs in a Part 4 proceeding or similar. Moving on now to page 3 and following, in terms of the actual procedure for making an application, it's covered in Order 10 of the Administration and Probate Rules. You need to file 3 documents at the time of making your application. The first is a summons, which is in the form in the rules. It's a fairly simple document. The second is an affidavit, which is largely pro forma as per the rules, but which also contains a recitation of the pains and troubles that the executor has had in managing the estate. And the third is an administration account. As to what you would include in the affidavit, there's a list in paragraph 18 which I've lifted from the loose leaf of wills, probate and administration, which I would commend to each of you. You would basically set out in short form, depending on the nature of the estate, the work that has been done by the executor. The summons, the first return of the summons is ex parte. At that point, the associate judge will make orders somewhat in the nature of those in Rule 1006. There are a number of matters set out there. I won't go through them now. You can look at that if you are so minded. There will usually be, first of all, the period whereby, or a direction whereby, the associate judge requires the executor to give notice to the residuary beneficiaries, and the beneficiaries then have the right to object to the grant of commission. In paragraph 22, I go through some of the factors or grounds of objection that you might have if acting for a beneficiary. In terms of having looked at the cases, I think that objectors can often find themselves in a difficult position. There will often have been a claim for executor's commission where there has been some form of estate litigation, such as Part 4. And if you are acting for a beneficiary who's objecting to executor's commission, it's probably more than likely that the beneficiary has also been a plaintiff in, or at least involved in, the Part 4 proceedings. And if the executor is claiming in the affidavit in support of the executor's commission claim that he or she has been put to pain and trouble in effect dealing with difficult beneficiaries in the course of an acrimonious Part 4 proceeding, and in your grounds of objection you then, I suppose, go hard in terms of making various allegations against the executor, then the fact that you have adopted that, I suppose, approach in the executor's commission proceeding may, in effect, bolster the claim by the executor that you were difficult to deal with, or that your client, rather, was difficult to deal with in the Part 4 proceeding. There's a balance that you need to strike. Obviously, it's a matter for each case and it's a matter of degree, but judging by some of the comments made in some of the cases to the effect, for example, that the executor or the beneficiaries viewed the executor with antipathy and derision. There was another quote in a later case involving warring siblings, and the executor was basically accused of all sorts of dishonesty in the course of the executor's commission claim. The judge found that those allegations were unfounded, but that they caused a great deal of anguish to the executor, and that anguish was something for which she should be compensated in the executor's commission claim. So you may find yourself in a difficult position. It's just something to consider, I suppose, when you're drawing objections and when you're acting for executors who, or beneficiaries rather, who wish to object. Following on from that, if we look from paragraph 24 onwards of the paper, and effectively, the question of whether commission is awarded is discretionary. Commission can be awarded up to 5% of the estate. It's fairly unlikely that commission will be rejected outright. Generally, the executor will receive something for commission, and depending on the amount of work done in the estate and the real assessment of the amount of the amount of pains and troubles, the percentage will really vary somewhat based on how much pains and troubles there have been and how much work there has been. Even if there's been misconduct on the executor's part or a breach of trust, that doesn't necessarily disentitle the executor to commission. It may just be that the commission is reduced. There's a case of Atkins and Godfrey, which again I believe Kate might be covering in her talk, which addresses the question of executor's neglect. There's also a case of Chiro and Linton, which I believe I've cited at the end of the paper, involving a delay in administration of an estate from 1972. I think the deceased died in 1969. The estate was not completed until 2009. The court found that it should have been completed in around about 1972 and so only allowed commission up until that point. So that's a way that the court found that there was a delay, an unreasonable delay in administration of the estate, and effectively made an allowance for that in the commission claim. In paragraph 27, I've set out some factors that Justice Smith, in the case of the estate of Stone, considered as relevant in assessing commission. I won't read through them. They're there for you. I thought, however, it might be useful to pull out some examples from the cases of matters that have been considered appropriate and not appropriate in relation to executors' commission cases. Where you have litigation that involves the estate, consider the nature of the litigation. If, for example, it involves construction of a clause of the will, it's unlikely that there's going to be the need for, first of all, the executor to have a great deal of involvement, unless, I suppose, the executor is a solicitor. And it's also unlikely that that litigation is going to be particularly acrimonious and cause the executor a great degree of trouble and pain. But do, I suppose, note the fact that where there is litigation and where it does involve the executor needing to, for example, consult with the beneficiaries, which would be your typical part four, the executor will be required to do more work, will be required to consult with the beneficiaries, the lawyers, particularly if it settles, for example, may have some role or at least quasi-role in assisting that settlement. So if you're acting for an objector, that might be something that you need to consider. As to the amount of work required, if the will provides for an annuity, provides for the necessity to invest funds, that will be something that generally requires more work, and that's been recognised in the cases. On the other hand, if the will requires the transfer of assets in specie, that is something that generally doesn't require as much work. As if, for example, a property needed to be sold and work needed to be done to employ real estate agents and things of that nature. Again, as to the nature of the work, there's a rather odd claim for executor's commission in the estate of Lindsay, which I have again referred to on the last page. The deceased in that case was a Buddhist, and the executor had sought to claim that, first of all, organising a Buddhist funeral ceremony, and secondly, distributing the assets of the estate in part to Buddhist charities involved more work and pains and trouble because the Buddhist ceremony and the Buddhist charities were outside the cultural mainstream, I think was the phrase used in that case, and His Honour found that that was not really indeed the case and in fact didn't quite understand what the concept of cultural mainstream meant. So it appears that even if you have someone who may be of a religion that is other than the executor or may be required to have some involvement with people that the executor may consider outside his or her own cultural mainstream, that's not necessarily something that will be relevant to the question of executor's commission. Also in that case, the executor had obtained the consent of some of the beneficiaries to commission at a particular rate, namely at the rate of, I think, 2.5%. But because he was unable to obtain the consent of all of the beneficiaries, he was required to make an application under the New South Wales equivalent of Section 65. He asked the court to take into account, in assessing the amount of commission, the fact that there had been partial agreement at 2.5%, and the court indicated that it was not prepared to do so, that it was exercising an independent discretion, and I believe awarded commission ultimately at 1% in that particular case, but I can't recall. It was something different from the agreed figure, and it was lower than the agreed figure. There had previously been used a scale for assessing commission in the case of Bar Smith, which is an old case. It's not necessarily, or you shouldn't be expecting to get commission at that rate nowadays. Instead, as I've stated in paragraph 31, you'd be more likely to get around about 2.5% to 3% on the corpus and 5% on the income, or up to 5% on the income. The other point, or almost the final point I wish to mention, is that the concept of a percentage claim from the estate applies no matter what the size of the estate, even though if you have a large estate, a percentage claim that's even, say, 2-3% may result in an executor obtaining commission in the tens of thousand dollars or possibly into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. That matter was considered in the case of Hawkins, which is a New South Wales case, and which Kate may also be intending to discuss. His Honour indicated in that case, His Honour Justice Slattery, that the terms of the legislation, which are very similar to the terms of the Victorian legislation, provide that a percentage is to be awarded, and there's not the ability to argue around that. And he also had indicated that there might be an increased administrative burden in larger states, more potential for litigation, and the possibility of more sophisticated and argumentative beneficiaries. I'm not sure whether that's completely restricted to larger states. I'm sure you're all aware of some smaller states where you have very sophisticated and argumentative beneficiaries. But it may be a factor that you wish to highlight if you do have a large estate and you have an executor seeking commission on that large estate. Finally, the question of costs. They are in the discretion of the court. They will generally be allowed out of the estate unless there is some other disqualifying factor. The recent case of the estate of Gray, in which Peter appeared, in which I'm sure he would have discussed with you all had he been here, provides, in effect, a warning that you shouldn't assume that you will get your costs out of the estate, or your client shouldn't assume that the costs will be paid out of the estate, and shouldn't, acting on that assumption, draw the costs from the estate before such an order is made. Finally, there is a list of recent cases which you may wish to have a look at. I've helpfully not provided you with the citation for the last case, which was the case involving the warring siblings that I mentioned earlier. If anyone is interested, that citation is 2010, New South Wales Supreme Court 173. There are also some additional cases not mentioned in my paper, which are mentioned in Kate's paper, if you did wish to do that additional reading. And that's pretty much all for me.